Okay. So hello and welcome to another edition of The Day to Day. I am Mark Higgins, and I'm joined today by our ocean expert and guide, Dr. Hayley Evers-King. Hayley, welcome.
Hi, Mark. Good to be with you again.
It's nice to see you again. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Yes, at home, as I think most of us are at the moment, but doing well.
Yes, of course, we are still recording remotely, and I'm imagining that's going to continue for a few months. Today, we are looking at carbon, and specifically carbon and the oceans. So I guess, Hayley, the big questions, how does carbon get into the oceans, out of the oceans, and what does it do when it's there? What are some of the bigger questions that oceanographers look at when they think about carbon?
Well, carbon is this really interesting topic. I mean, wherever you look at, I mean, if you're looking at the ocean or if you're looking on land or you're looking at the atmosphere, it's this huge topic at the moment because carbon is so fundamental to the way so much of how our Earth functions, in particular, anything that relates to life. I mean, we are these kind of carbon-based organisms after all. So, I mean, it's a really, really big issue anywhere you look on the Earth system, but particularly in the oceans being, you know, these vast, vast patches of water that cover a huge portion of our planet. They always have a big piece to add to any puzzle when we're looking at what's going on with our Earth. And from the perspective of carbon, at the moment we have, you know, ongoing big issue when it comes to things like anthropogenic climate change, carbon in the form of carbon dioxide being released into the atmosphere from the burning of fossil fuels. And the oceans act as a kind of reservoir, but also a sort of source and a sink of carbon. And we talk about this in terms of fluxes. We'll discuss a bit more with our guest today exactly what fluxes are when it comes to the ocean and it comes to carbon. But the ocean is kind of responsible for moving and expressing carbon in different ways, in different components, both within it and between the different aspects of our Earth. So the ocean takes some carbon in, it sends some carbon out to the atmosphere, for example. And exactly how it does this, over what time frames, is a big set of questions that we have to understand if we want to know what's going to happen when it comes to things like climate change.
And I guess it's not as simple as certain amount of carbon goes in and quite quickly a certain amount of carbon comes out. From what I've understood listening to you, that the circulation processes can take quite some time.
Yeah, so the ocean has, you know, a physical part to it. It also has a lot of biological parts to it. And both of these components of the ocean have a role to play in our carbon cycling when we talk about the carbon cycle on Earth as a whole. So the surface of our oceans are obviously interfacing with our atmosphere all the time, but the deep ocean is not. And the ocean circulates. So the amount of surface water that is in touch with the atmosphere and its carbon content can change over time. Similarly, the amount of carbon that is absorbed in different ways because of the different types of life that are living in the ocean varies both through time and through space. So actually how the ocean interacts with carbon is something that isn't consistent in both time and space. And that's where these questions come in about what's going to happen when it comes to, you know, the next 50, 100 years plus on the climate scale. We're trying to figure out now, how is the ocean going to react to this?
Now, of course, we are remote sensing geeks. So the question then comes quickly, how much of this can we actually monitor from space? Carbon dioxide, it's an invisible gas. Oceans, we can't see into them. What is it that we're actually monitoring when we talk about monitoring this kind of thing from space?
As I said before, the role that ocean plays in the carbon cycle is complicated, and it's this kind of mix of physical and biological parameters that determine its role in the carbon cycle. And it varies a lot on these different time and space scales. And so satellite data itself really naturally lends itself to helping us to observe those physical and biological processes at the relevant time and space scales. And in fact, it would be very difficult to get a sort of complete picture of what's going on in the ocean without the data that we can get from satellites. So whether it's physical aspects such as ocean currents or the winds, waves, all these different things we can look at from satellites, or the biological side. We've spoken in the past about the production that goes on in the oceans at the kind of primary producer level from things like phytoplankton. These are all things that we can observe to a degree with satellites, and they're part of the whole ocean carbon cycle picture.
So I guess if we look at a chunk of ocean surface or a small piece of ocean surface, I find it quite easy to imagine heat from the sun travels into the ocean, warms it up. Okay, so one bit of transfer, or I guess at night, maybe the other way around, a nice warm ocean heats up the atmosphere. We've spoken previously about the biology that lives just in the ocean surfaces. What other kind of transfers or movement of things between the atmosphere and the ocean could we be talking about?
We're also looking at gas exchanges. So like at the surface of the ocean, how the ocean moves, like how rough it is, how much wind there is, how many waves there are. All of this can affect how much gas is able to transfer between the surface and the surface of the ocean and the atmosphere and vice versa. So those kind of physical processes at this quite high scale are quite important. The other things that we also need to be aware of are the like different chemical reactions that happen, which are going on in both the atmosphere and from the ocean side. And these are a little bit more tricky to see with satellites because we can't necessarily always detect these directly, but we can understand using different processes that we can measure using the satellites. We can then start estimating what the kind of chemical behavior is going to be. And this is where we start bringing together data from sort of satellite perspective, the in situ perspective, and also our sort of models and our understanding from a theoretical perspective to give this whole picture, from the atmosphere into the oceans and in the sort of three dimensions that we, look in if we have to consider the whole planetary system.
And this is, this is a huge area of scientific research. I think previously when we were involved in the Oceans from Space Massive Open Online course, we had Helen Chersky from the UK who was involved, who was researching the role of bubbles in gas exchange. That's one of her big research area. And today we are joined by Dr. Jamie Shuttler from the University of Exeter in Cornwall. Jamie, welcome.
Hello, thank you, Mark. Thank you for having me.
So what are some of your major curiosities when it comes to exchanges between the atmosphere and the ocean?
Well, we're interested in studying this exchange for carbon and climate, as Hayley's just mentioned, but also for ocean health. So we need to understand how much carbon's being absorbed by the ocean, where it's going. And then that gives us an idea of the potential impact that it's having on the marine life that live in the oceans.
And so what kind of data are you using to do this research?
So satellites are actually pretty key to this work because the oceans are so large, they're so vast that it's really hard. There is no other way of actually observing them apart from using satellites. So we use their satellite observations in combination with ship measurements and measurements from buoys and coastal buoy arrays. And we combine all of that and we can study how the gases are exchanging at the surface. We also get an indication of where the carbon is going once it's been absorbed. And we can also identify regions of the ocean which are likely being impacted more by this absorption of carbon than others.
Mm-hmm. And are there any particular areas geographically that you work on?
So we work globally. We study and quantify carbon on a global case, and we provide information, and that gives into annual global carbon assessments. But we also have particular interest in areas which are more vulnerable to the absorption of carbon and the impact it has, this long-term change in the water chemistry that's referred to as ocean acidification. So we study areas of coral reefs, we study river outflows where large amounts of low pH water is flowing into the ocean from the land. But essentially what I'm trying to say is we study it at all scales, right from the regional and local up to the global case.
Yeah. And so if we maybe, because Hayley and I, we talked really quickly then about the bigger picture, the ocean surface exchanges and all the sorts of things that can go on. Maybe if we take it a bit slower, if we have some carbon dioxide in the atmosphere just above the ocean surface, talk us through how it actually gets into the ocean.
So it can. There are lots of different stages to the process, but the main controller is our surface turbulent exchange. So this comes back to what you were saying before about bubbles and Helen's work. So this is a turbulent exchange with the atmosphere, and the breaking waves and wind impact of wind on the surface actually allow the gas to be mixed down into the water. The other controller is temperature. So colder water can actually absorb more gas than a warmer ocean. So these are physical controls on the amount of gas going into the water. The way in which it can be controlled is the concentration differences between the atmosphere and what's in the water. So if you have plants growing in the water, the plankton, and they're taking up carbon dioxide, but they're also breathing out as well. And this change in the concentration within the water can actually change the way in which the carbon dioxide moves between the atmosphere and the water.
So this is the amount of oxygen that's then actually released back into the atmosphere above from plankton, and Hayley's talked about this in the past, and then the carbon dioxide is being mixed in. How does this lead to acidification then?
Well, the oceans historically, before the Industrial Revolution, so before 1800, were actually a source of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. And the only human or anthropogenic impact we had on the carbon cycle as a whole was to do with linked to deforestation and land use change. But post-Industrial Revolution, when we started burning fossil fuels for energy, we have turned the ocean from a source of carbon dioxide into a sink. And these increasing atmospheric concentrations are effectively forcing the carbon dioxide into the ocean. And the ocean has an ability to hold much more carbon than the atmosphere holds. And it is actually the second largest store of carbon on Earth, the first being the mantle, the core of the Earth. So in this way, we're effectively forcing the system. So the more we put into the atmosphere, the more of it goes into the oceans.
And then I guess you've got some of these big ocean circulations that then take the carbon rich, for want of a better word, water down into the deeper circulation, or?
Yes, exactly. So the exchange happens at the interface between the atmosphere and the water at the very surface of the water. Then once it's in the water, things like the plankton, the plants can modulate the concentrations and maybe use up some of that carbon dioxide. But also the long-term and sort of deep water movement takes the water away from the surface in places like the poles in the Antarctic and Arctic regions. And then it locks that carbon away for hundreds of years. So the carbon that's currently coming out of the ocean in equatorial regions where we have very warm water, and so the carbon dioxide is being exhaled, that was actually absorbed by the ocean before the 1800s, so before the Victorian period. So this is really old carbon dioxide. It's now coming out of the ocean. And this ability for the ocean to lock away carbon for really long periods is why it's so important for the global carbon and why it's such a large carbon store.
One of the ways I know that we've looked at, as oceanographers, the circulation that Jamie's talking about and how long it takes. And by proxy, then that will, you know, it kind of locks in carbon for a time and it'll circulate around the ocean for quite a long time, longer than most of our lifetimes, and then eventually be released again. The question of how do we know this is quite important. And I know one of the ways they've looked at this using a proxy, so not measuring carbon directly, but looking at the transport of the ocean and trying to trace how long it takes, is actually through CFCs, which we all know as these, you know, bad things that were involved in, you know, creating the hole in the ozone that we have over the poles. But CFCs are really interesting because we know exactly when they started being released into the atmosphere and we know exactly when they stopped. And so you can actually take a boat and go through from, say, the North Atlantic towards the equator. And you can take profiles and different measurements of water from all the way down through the depths. And you can actually track where the water, you know, at one point was absorbed at the surface and then transported down into the depths and moved through these big ocean circulations. And I always find this utterly fascinating how these, you know, really... I mean, it's an kind of a negative story we think about when it comes to the CFCs, but how we've been able to use this as a proxy enhancing our understanding of such an important part of the ocean and the carbon cycle as well. So that, I know that's one way we're looking at, like, how long is this going to take and how long have we got kind of before that carbon comes back to haunt us that's been absorbed in recent times as well.
So we're acidifying the ocean through this carbon process as well. What are some of the effects that are directly observed from acidification You mentioned, I think, the coral bleaching issue earlier. Are there others?
It's not coral bleaching. So coral bleaching is related to temperature. So coral bleaching is predominantly a response to temperature stress of coral. So if they get experienced at very high temperatures, it kills the algae, which is growing on the calcified structure of the coral, and that dies. And that's why the coral then appears white, because it has it's the symbiotic relationship it has with the algae. The algae is dead, and that's why you refer to it as bleaching. But the issue with ocean acidification is that the process of absorbing carbon dioxide means that it releases hydrogen into the water, and then that means that it lowers the pH, which is why people refer to it as acidification. But it also uses up the mineral in the water called carbonate. And this mineral is important for the growth of many marine animals, but particularly for corals or hard-shelled animals. And if there's less of that mineral in the water, it becomes harder for them to grow. It also, in some cases, becomes harder for them to reproduce or attach to a substrate, for example, if they're a shellfish. And therefore, it has, you know, in some ways, the oceans have helped to slow the impacts of global warming and of climate change, or at least the impacts that we as humans feel directly. But it is having this negative impact upon marine life that live in the oceans.
Mm. And you're actually, if I understood correctly, you're actually studying both heat in the ocean as well as carbon in the ocean.
We aren't. My work is not studying the heat in the ocean, but it is important for, you have to be able to understand the temperature and the water, particularly the very surface water temperature, the skin, sort of a sub-millimeter scale temperature of the water, to be able to quantify the exchange of carbon between the atmosphere and the ocean.
Right. So for you, it's a control thing about affecting the rate of your process that you're most interested in.
Yeah, exactly. So the colder the water, the more carbon it can absorb, and then vice versa, the warmer the water, the less carbon it can absorb, which is predominantly why you will have a lot of absorption of carbon in the polar regions, so in the Arctic or Antarctic, where you have colder water, and then that sinking, and that water then sinks and forms this deep water circulation, internal circulation within the ocean. Whereas you predominantly get outgassing or carbon dioxide leaving the water in equatorial regions because you have this much warmer water.
Now, the Earth observing data that we at UMetSat look after most to do with the oceans, I guess in the most recent years, we've been looking after Sentinel-3. So looking at biology and temperature and dynamics. But we've got a longer record with sea surface temperature data. And I'm imagining you're looking at data sets that are quite long. So what kind of data are you looking at when you study the carbon?
Studying carbon is actually quite exciting because we use a whole host of different measurements and observations from satellites. So predominantly, as I've said, we're really interested in sea surface temperature because that's really key for the gas going into solution into the ocean. But we have to use wind and wave data to describe the turbulence, the surface turbulent exchange between the atmosphere and the ocean. We're also interested in identifying biology and biological processes within the ocean. So, for example, we use chlorophyll concentrations. We're interested in net community production. So this is about how much carbon the plants take up in the ocean, but also how much they breathe out as they grow and die. And so there's a whole host of different measurements. And in particular, salinity is also important for the carbonate system, because that helps us understand how things are mixing in coastal regions, but also out into the global ocean.
So what is it you're actually doing? Talk me through, because you've described a whole bunch of parameters there and a whole different set of processes that can be going on in the atmosphere. What's your sort of science story? What are you actually doing?
So there's two halves to our work. A lot of it is about the exchange at the surface, and this helps us to quantify the sink, the carbon sink, the amount of carbon that the oceans absorb every year. And then if we track that through time, that allows us to determine whether it's changing, increasing, or decreasing. But we also are interested in identifying regions which are more vulnerable or more susceptible to changes in the ocean carbon system. And this is where temperature and salinity come into play, because we're interested in understanding how the alkalinity within the water, so this is the ability of the water to buffer a change in acidity, but also the how much of these low pH waters that we have flowing from land into the ocean and how they're influencing coastal coral reefs and fisheries and this kind of thing. So the work feeds into conservation efforts. And so, for example, we work with the World Wildlife Fund in one of our particular projects.
And so are you also, in some sense, are you modeling? Are you just measuring? What are some of the some of the science you're actually doing underneath this?
So it's a combination of all of those. So we rely on measurements, so in situ measurements, but we also, and we parameterize the exchange based on theory we know from tank measurements, and then we apply these globally. But we also use empirical models. So these are models based on measurements to understand how that varies, how the conditions vary spatially and through time.
So this is, you look at a tank, so you actually grow some plants. You measure precisely what's going to be going on in those plants, and then you extrapolate that out to a sort of the ocean environment. Or is it a bit more complicated than that?
Okay.
Just to give you background, I'm a meteorologist. I do clouds.
Okay. So yeah, the theory of how we describe the exchange between the atmosphere and the ocean is from, and this is based predominantly on physics, is work that was first evaluated within tanks, and then they took it into ship measurements, and they did it using gases, different rates of different gases exchanging between the surface and the atmosphere. And then that theory is then applied to how, and the measurements that we can take from a satellite. Essentially, we can measure ship wind speed from a ship, and we relate that to the turbulence. Therefore, we can measure wind speed from a satellite, and we can relate that to the turbulence as well.
Okay, so you're then, so you've got an estimate. So you've got these big satellite measurements, but you've actually got some degree of ground truth that says, okay, this model's reasonably good for looking at these gas exchange type processes. Yeah,
absolutely. So the measurements from ships are absolutely critical, both for calibrating and evaluating the accuracy and precision of our approaches that we use and we derive from the satellite observations.
Yeah, cool. Now, Hayley and I, because by being involved with the Sentinel Project, this is part of the European Union's Copernicus Initiative. So not only is it about gathering satellite data, it's also about getting data towards user communities to then do stuff and make decisions. And I guess you're the same. So you're a university researcher, but you're sitting inside a wider European research environment and community. And I guess you've been involved in bigger projects. So talk to me about some of the projects that you're involved in.
Yes. So we work quite a lot with the European Space Agency.
Yep.
We've worked with them for studying gas fluxes and also for studying the surface ocean carbonate system. So in relation to the work we've doing in relation to coral reefs and fisheries. And we use a lot of Copernicus data for those. We use obviously satellite observations extensively, as I've already talked about, but also we use model reanalysis data, which comes from the Copernicus services as well.
And I guess it's talk to me a little bit about how your research feeds into other people's research and the whole system. Because I guess I'm never going to bump into, as a citizen, your research directly. But the chances are, indirectly, I may have bumped into a decision or somebody's done something differently based on something that you've fed into. How do you draw a line? We unwind a bit. Talking to Helen Chersky about some of her research with bubbles. It's very sort of esoteric, going out on ships, measuring gas exchange processes and bubbles. And you go to, well, where is that used? And there's some really quite important places it does get used, particularly in say, climate modelling eventually. And the same, I imagine, is true of yours. So where does it fit into sort of the whole thing, and where might I bump into it indirectly?
Probably the one that pops into my mind immediately is our work with the World Wildlife Fund. So we use the satellites to identify which coral reefs, for example, are more susceptible or being impacted greater from very large changes in the carbonate system, so big changes in the pH. And then the intention is that they will then use that information to define areas of ocean which should be protected or conserved in some way. So for example, it may mean that they identify that a particular reef needs to be looked after, or that they can study that particular set of reefs to understand how they are being impacted or coping in some cases with these large changes in the carbonate system. And you can't, the only way you can do that is for using a satellite observations, because you know these, some of these places are very hard to get to. And some of them are in very extreme environments, such as if you're interested in areas around the Arctic.
Mm. And what have been some of the, what are the challenges? What are the hard things inside your work? What's difficult?
A lot of the difficulty often comes to convincing and explaining and trying to allow people to understand that a measurement that's taken 600 kilometers up from an orbiting satellite is as good and in some cases is even better than a measurement that's taken by a ship or someone sampling water. And so it is, and I still find it quite exciting, the fact that you can measure the skin of the water, so sort of the depth of less than a millimeter, the temperature of that water from a satellite that's orbiting 600 kilometers up. And you cannot do that any other way, as in it is impossible to do that over those huge areas if you want to try and do it from a ship.
And it's quite, so one of the hidden activities that we get quite involved in is what we call calibration validation. So the making sure that when we say this is the temperature of the skin of the ocean, that we really understand that that's what it is, and we've got lots of data to back that statement up. And there's huge, there's people all around the world involved in this, and it's quite hidden work. So in a way, for me, it's quite exciting hearing you talk about how you then use the temperature data to do useful things, because that's why all of the validation activities are really useful. What's the future of your work? So what's the sort of the cutting edge of some of what you're involved in at the moment?
Well, some of our most recent results have actually identified that the ocean is absorbing more carbon than we previously thought.
Mm-hmm.
And this comes back to the understanding of the skin of the water. Because you have at the very sort of edge, the boundary between the atmosphere and the ocean, you have heat fluxes where the sun is heating the surface of the water, and then some of that heat is given back off again, whether that's they referred to as a latent or a sensible heat process. So some of this is energy giving back to the atmosphere, but some of it was also lost as a result of things like water evaporating out and formation of clouds. But you need to know that to be able to study the gas fluxes. And that heat change means that the very surface of the water is cooler than the water below it. And if you don't account for that cooler water, it means you underestimate, globally, you underestimate the amount of carbon being absorbed by the oceans. And this is work that we've just published at the end of last year. And so this is the accounting for this in global carbon accounting is likely to have knock-on effects, where it means that we now have to rethink about how we're actually quantifying global carbon. Because if more is going into the ocean, that means less is going somewhere else.
That's really interesting. Jamie, I wanted to ask you a question about talking about the future. You know, obviously we're using these satellites and a lot of them are really super modern and we're learning new things all the time, but where do you see this going? I mean, what do you think would be useful for you going forward in terms of new satellite data, new technologies on the horizon, even, you know, new methods and things that we're using scientifically? Where does the tech future sit with your work?
It's at the moment, Hayley, it's actually in a really exciting time. The kind of this explosion of different satellite technologies and orbiting platforms is quite phenomenal at the moment. So one area in which we're not seeing very much exploitation, certainly within carbon and for ocean acidification, is all of these nano satellites, which are now available, you know, for example, with Planet Labs and even universities getting into this approach and building their own. A lot of these satellite centers, their accuracy and precision is nowhere near that of the Copernicus satellite and sensors. But in conjunction, the two of those different approaches means that you can use the Copernicus work for calibrating and verifying the accuracy of your approaches. But then you can use all of these smaller, less accurate satellites for actually understanding how things are changing through time.
Yeah, it's really cool. I mean, for me, it's always amazing how the more you bring different data sources together, the more you can find out. But I mean, I know that comes with a lot of challenges as well. One of the things we're looking at more and more, and I know in the Earth observation community, it's a real hot topic at the moment, is artificial intelligence and machine learning. Is this something you're coming across in your work more and more now?
Yes, this is becoming increasingly important. So this is important for short-term forecasting, because some of these techniques hold the capability for us to be able to say, okay, in 6 months' time, what is it like? What's the ocean carbon system likely to be looking like? Which areas are likely to be impacted? So that's a really key area at the moment for research. And there's a lot of opportunity there in terms of exploiting the Copernicus program, but also all of these new artificial intelligence and machine learning approaches. But they're also, these techniques are incredibly important and already extensively being used for quantifying the oceanic carbon sink. Because we have this problem where there are particular measurements which you can only collect from a ship or from a buoy or from sampling water physically at the water surface. But because the oceans are so large, they cover over 70% of the Earth's surface, you can't get everywhere all of the time. It's not financially or physically possible to do that. And so we rely upon satellite observations along with machine learning and artificial intelligence approaches like neural networks to actually interpolate those sparse in situ data so that we can then have these quantities across the whole of the global oceans. And so This is an example of where the use of satellite observations is not always clear, but has been and is being extensively used within this area of research.
But I think, in a way, for me, that's one of the exciting things about the state of a lot of science right now, is we have a lot of data, we have quite a lot of computing infrastructure, we have a lot of new ideas around artificial intelligence and machine learning, and we have a good understanding of statistics and how to work with uncertainty. So actually, a lot of the building blocks you need to do what you're describing are actually there. So it's not an overly courageous scientific step, but it's just hard.
Yes, it is. It's very hard in terms of handling the amount of data and observations, but it's also highly multidisciplinary. So you have this issue where there are lots of different communities and they all have their way and approach of working and their understanding of these different systems. But the important thing and the biggest kind of advances can only be made when you ensure that all of those communities interact and work with each other, which is increasingly hard. Yeah.
And I guess a few years ago, we would have expected an individual to turn up with all of the skills. And that's just impossible now. You use the word, it's communities of people trying to work together.
Yes, exactly. And so it's unlikely that one person is able to provide all of the information and knowledge you need for this. And so working across these different communities and with them, and the fact you're working between modelers and satellite observation scientists, as well as in situ and field scientists and lab scientists, all of these experiences and knowledge are really needed to be able to accurately quantify the amount of carbon going into the ocean, but also understand where it's impacting and what the impact is having upon the marine life.
It's a very good point. I think it's really hard for me to think of another issue that so well encapsulates like the diversity and multidisciplinarity needed in oceanography these days than, looking at the ocean carbon cycle. It takes everything from our technical diversity through to our sort of, scientific methodological diversity and into the sciences themselves, the physics, the chemistry, the biology. You really can't get hope to get a handle on this cycle without bringing all of that together, which makes it an incredibly compelling kind of topic for me.
Mm. Yes, exactly. One of the reasons why I find it so exciting as well is because you have to have all of these different skills and all these different people, it's a very, in some ways, it's quite it's a hard area to work in, but it also can be very, very exciting and rewarding, because you can see these advances being made by working across all these different communities.
Mm. Now, of course, we're recording during the one of the coronavirus, restricted times. So we're probably all at home, not traveling much. One of the things I've noticed during this time is all of the relationships that we've got, they've all kept on going. All the conversations that we have across different organizations, they've all kept on going. The thing I really miss is conference meals and dinners and sitting with people when we can actually talk about all of this stuff. and talk about where the problems are and the pain is. And it's not so much the problem solving, because we can do that remotely. It's sort of just sharing together and building that sense of, hold on, we need to work on this bit now. How's that going
science
for you?
Science on a beer mat. This is the bit I miss, is being, you know, yes. you go for a pint, you have a beer mat, and you say, you know, what if I bring this bit of my work together with your bit of your work? Like, does that work? Yeah, I think we're missing that quite a lot. It's been very challenging, especially to this kind of science.
Yes, absolutely. I completely agree. And in some ways, often those social interactions are far more important than some of the going through some of the technical details. And it's often in those environments where some of the largest sort of advances are seeded and started. So yeah, it's incredibly important for those. But it's also, as you said, increasingly difficult to have them.
They will return. I'm sure of it. So Jamie, we're just entering the UN Decade of Ocean Science. What does that mean, having a decade of ocean science?
Well, the United Nations have recognised that the importance of ocean science. So this is ocean science for sustainable development. So this is about understanding how we're impacting the oceans, but also what that impact is having in terms of our well-being, our food resources, the atmosphere and climate which we experience and live within. And so a lot of the work that we've been doing, so the work with the European Space Agency, looking at ocean acidification, the work we've done with gas fluxes, sort of European studies we've performed on understanding how much of the carbon's and how it's moving and where it's moving between the atmosphere and the ocean. All of this helps feed into this decade of ocean science to improve our understanding and our ability to understand how the oceans are changing and what they may change to or how they may change in the future.
Right. Jamie, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. And for me, you know, coming from a satellite agency, it's really quite exciting to hear how the data actually get used. How the work that's done on our side through the UMETSAT programs and through the Copernicus programs and looking after data, how that can actually turn into useful science. Thank you very much indeed. And Hayley, thank you as well to you. Pleasure to see and speak to you again. So thank you for listening. We'll post some links to Jamie's work in the notes for this podcast. And if you're interested in some of the ocean stories, do follow us on our Twitter channels, Facebook, and on the UMETSAT website. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll hear you next time, or see you next time.